Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Your Bible to Titus chapter 1. I'll only be looking at a few verses tonight, but some very important verses. Some that you might be familiar with if you have read through 1 Timothy 3 any time recently, because they're almost in many ways a parallel. So let's look, if we could, beginning at verse 5. Paul says, I'm using the Williams translation. It'll be a little different than yours, but that's on purpose to make you look at your text. I left you in Crete. Now, apparently Paul had come to Crete in Acts 27 on his way to Rome. But as you remember, he came to Crete, but he didn't preach at all on Crete in Acts 27. So I don't believe this can refer to Acts 27. I believe this is a fourth missionary journey after Paul was released from prison, because there is evangelistic preaching on Crete. There is to be churches started on Crete, and so this does not fit in the chronology of Acts. Crete, we think, is the home of the Philistines, possibly. And it became a very important place for the church to start a new work. And so Paul must have been there, preached briefly, started the process of organizing the churches, but moved on for whatever reason. And he left his very trusted person, Titus, there. Now look what it says about the purpose. For this express purpose, to do two things. Number one, to set in order the things that are lacking. Now, that sounds a little tough. I think it meant the things that I had not been able to do. I started the process, Titus. I didn't finish it. We talked about this orally. I'm going to put it in writing so the church will know that you're my... I think that Titus is acting as an apostolic surrogate. Titus is not acting as a pastor. He's not acting as an area bishop. He's acting as Paul's official representative. He's speaking with the authority of Paul. He's doing what Paul has told him to do. So maybe an apostolic surrogate is a better way of thinking about this. And second, to appoint elders. Now I need to stop here a little bit to do two things. I want to do a word study on elders. I want to discuss this different polity about Titus appointing elders. Now, the word elder in Greek is the word we get the denomination Presbyterian from, presbyteroi, okay? It has an Old Testament background. It comes from all the elders of the tribes that Moses worked with in the Exodus. Now, I believe the word elder and the word bishop. Now, the word bishop in Greek is much like the denominational name episcopal. We call them episcopoi. And it is translated sometimes bishop, sometimes overseer. It has a background from the Greek city-states. So really, the two terms are synonymous for what we would call the pastor. Now, if that seems uncomfortable to you, I would like for you to look at, maybe not now, but write it down, the parallel account in Acts chapter 20, verse 17 and 28. Paul is going to call the Ephesian elders, and then he's going to address them as bishops. Now, I think that elders and bishops are our term for pastor, and I get that also from first chapter of Titus, verse 5 and verse 7, where the word, the other word for them is used. So I think that the early church had more than one pastor, because it was only usually one congregation in these early cities. And that means, I think, that if we put it in our day, that means that calling a minister of music and a minister of youth and a minister of education is a very biblical process, because we are all different gifts, but all, in a sense, elders or overseers. And so I don't hold to do different office. The Bible does say And of Philippians 1:1, there are two offices in the local church, pastor and deacon. And those two offices, I think, are mentioned in Philippians 1:1. Now, the other thing here about a point in each town, this is different than in 1 Timothy. There, the congregation is going to vote. Here, Titus is going to appoint. Now, I want to say something. I'm a little nervous about tonight because I'm going to kick a couple of Baptist sacred cows, and I'm not sure you know me well enough to know how to take it. I am not trying to throw everything out that we do. I am not trying to say that my interpretation is the only interpretation of this passage. But I am trying to get you to think through what you've always heard this has to mean. Do you hear what I'm doing with you? So sometimes I do play the devil's advocate on purpose. And sometimes I want to challenge you in just what you have accepted. Now, this idea of ordination, I think it is absolutely unbiblical. I believe the ordination of preacher and of deacons does not have enough biblical roots for us to claim that it's a biblical process. You say, what do you mean? I think anything we do that causes us to get into a them and us mentality, those ministers and us poor lay people, those clergy and us poor others, is absolutely unbiblical. Ordination should do nothing to make a distinction between leadership types and minister types in the Church of Jesus Christ. If it has any biblical basis, it's for the church setting apart certain people to do a certain task. And we get that from Acts, where the church sent out Paul and Barnabas. I think this comes about sometimes when we... I'm just going to throw this out, and don't throw anything at me. I'm getting older. I can't dodge. Let's just take something like the ordination of deacons. And we're going to... This list here is not deacons, it's elders. But 1 Timothy, the parallel, does have deacons in it. You know, we get so upset because of... I heard somebody say that we send women to our seminaries to be trained, but the churches won't take them back because Southern Baptists are scared to death about ordaining women. Let's throw out ordination. And let's continue to realize that God gifts and uses women in His kingdom. It's particularly true of deacons. I think there's biblical evidence, Romans 16:1, and historical evidence of women deacons. I think the widow's role of the pastoral epistles wherein shows that the church hired women over 60 whose husband had died and paid them to do ministry tasks. See, our problem is we think of deacons or executive boards. If deacons are servants, there's no question there ought to be women servants, because there's many things that men cannot do. Now, I just want to throw that out, not for you to start gagging in your pew, because that would distress me, but I want you to think of some of these things that we've locked down so hard don't always hold water when you really look at them biblically. Now, Titus was to appoint. Now, what did that mean? Crete was a new church. The other church was established. The other church had time to look for leaders and the congregation to affirm them. I think Titus had the job of going into every church, finding, if he could, the gifted men there and appointing them to the task to get those churches started and going before he left. You see, again, we have been told that the polity structure in the Bible is congregational polity. I would remind you again that in Acts 15, all three polity types that Christians use, which is basically Episcopal, Presbyterian, and congregational, can be seen in Acts 15. Now, it looks like to me as a Baptist, and I am a Baptist, it looks like to me that we're moving at the death of the apostles into congregational polity. But all three forms of a one godly leader who seems to influence many and lead many, to a group of elders who discuss it privately, and then to a group of the congregation voting. Paul tells Titus, appoint elders in every city. Because the church was small, apparently, and there was not the time to go through the process that would normally have been done. And I think we have to live with that. I don't think it I don't think it's meant to build a theology on, but we have to realize that sometimes we get just too dogmatic. Notice it says, appoint elders in every town. So there'll be different towns where these churches started. And then Paul says, as I directed you. This is a very strong Greek construction. It's an aorist middle imperative, which means once and for all, I myself. It's a construction that focuses on the author, the subject. Paul's saying, I told you, Titus, specifically what to do. So what is Titus doing? He's following the apostolic dictates of Paul. So when the church says, we don't like the way you're doing it, you shouldn't do that, Titus says, look, I am following what Paul said. Paul is the apostle, and I'm giving you his directions. He gave them to me orally, and now he's written them down so you know that it's coming from him. And so it's this ideal of authority. Now, in verse 6, each elder must be... Now, I want to look at your Bibles here for a minute, because our time tonight is only going through verse 9. And what we have here is qualifications for Christian leaders. And this is a controversial list, as is the one in 1 Timothy 3. The lists are different, by the way. This one's much more structured. What does your Bible have? And I'd like you to kind of talk back to me a little bit. Each elder must be, now my Williams says, above reproach. And in verse 7, it's the same word. As God's trustee, a pastor must be above reproach. Now, tell me what NIV has there. Blameless, okay? What does King James have there? Blameless too? Does any other translation here? Well thought of. I think that's good. I think the Greek here is a word that would mean no handle for criticism. Now, that's going to be really important to me, and I'm going to make a lot of hay right here, so please kind of follow with me. No handle for criticism. Now, this word is used about 5, 6 times in 1 Timothy. 3 times in 1 Timothy 3 on the qualifications of leaders. It's kind of like this. Titus is going to go into a town, and he's going to look at the people in the church. And he's going to try to find people who have not disqualified themselves by something in their past, in their life, in their family, in their relationship to others. He's looking for men who have no handle for criticism from people inside the church or people outside the church. He's looking for leaders that are going to be acceptable to the believing community and the unbelieving community. Now, in light of that, he's going to give some guidelines. And some of these guidelines, I think, are extremely interesting because they're so hard to know what to do with. Look at them. Have only one wife. Oh, croak, have we fought over that. There's about 3 theories, I think, that will hold water. The one that really, I think, won't hold water is, it's got to be a married man. You mean Jesus can't be an elder? I mean, how ridiculous is that? Paul can't be an elder? That won't hold water, will it? This is not saying he's got to be a married man. I don't know if this church has elected single deacons. We certainly have single staff members. I mean, it can't be what it means. Okay, what does it mean? All right, here's one view. It means you can't have more than one wife at a time. You can't be a polygamist. Now, that would solve all the problems. Oh, great, I don't have more than one wife, so this doesn't apply to me. There's only one problem. Polygamy was not a problem in the Jewish community or the Roman community of Paul's day. Just wasn't a problem at all. Nobody did that. It'd be having a qualification that didn't apply to anybody. So it can't mean polygamy. So that'd be an easy way out of it. Some say if a minister type is married and his wife dies, he can't marry again. Second marriage. Now, that's the way Europe interprets this. That's the way Tertullian interpreted this. That's the way the early church, many of them, thought this meant. You can't have a second wife. The hair pull has been over divorce. Now, divorce was a problem in Rome. We have documented evidence that one woman was bragging in the literature of being divorced 47 times. The lawyers loved her. I think this is probably in context talking about divorce. Now, when I say that, I want to make a couple of qualifications to that, because I can't live with it just with that statement. Does this mean, since the person was saved, well, I'm attracted to that, because there's something in me that says, my goodness, we ordain to the gospel ministry murderers and convicts and cannibals and everything. So suddenly we can't do a divorced person? Is divorce the unpardonable sin? That won't hold water, I don't think. There's got to be a distinction between what happened since you met Christ. Is there a track record of godliness since then? And yet the downside of that is, this was a new church, and that can't be the implication in Titus. Why? Because they hadn't been saved very long. So though I'm attracted to that, I got some biblical problems with it. Okay? What if you're in a marriage where your spouse one day says, buzz off, I'm leaving, and I don't care, and you can do what you want to. Goodbye. Now, I know it takes two to tango, and it takes two in a marriage, but there are places where the spouse, for mental illness, drug addiction, alcohol abuse, or just wants out, leaves, right? What about the person who didn't do anything, apparently, and everybody will tell you that, but now they find themselves divorced? What about that person? So, I wish I knew what I believed here. I'm not sure what I believe here. I think that godly men is the key. Is divorce something that would cause someone not to be qualified? Now, it looks to me like that Paul is saying Christians have to hold up a standard. There are things that we can do that might remove us from some areas of ministry, but would not remove us from ministry. I think there's some truth in that statement. But does that solve all the problems? No. So I think that what we have to do is say, whether it's deacons or preachers or whatever, you know, if you go to Southwestern Seminary and you're divorced, you have to go before a committee. Do you know that? And you got to talk to that committee about what happened. And if that committee thinks that you weren't the offending party and that your life is solid, you are following the Lord, there's a track record there, they let you into seminary. I think there's some wisdom there in dealing with this. I don't think a red D hung around our neck forever is the answer. Because, you see, if I do it here, I got to be dogmatic of the rest of these, and the rest of these are scaring me to death. Because some of these disqualify me. Okay, let's go to the second one. So here's the husband of one wife. Children must not be liable to the charge, and here's a couple of problems with authority. Now, golly, I don't know how many preachers you know, but there's a good percent of them whose kids have not turned out the way they want. Amen? Now, when I've done everything I know to bring my kids up in the church and the Lord and share my personal testimony and pray for them, does that mean that if my kids, in some period of their life, choose to be rebel rousers or wild livers, that I resign from being a pastor? Or does that mean that if I was older and my kids were not doing exactly what they should, that I should never have been asked to be a minister? Do you see how that would make every minister vulnerable to the free choice of others? Now, if the life of the children reflect the life of the family, meaning disregard for authority, independent self-will living, then what the sin in the kids, if that's reflected in the dad shouldn't be a leader of the church. What this is saying is, let me put it a little bit broader. If there are problems at home, you don't make the person a leader in the church. That's the broad category. The way you deal with the home, people who know you best, people who live with you, reflects how you're going to deal with the home of God, the church of God, the family of God. And so, is one area we look at the family life? How is the relationship between the husband and the wife? How are the relationship with the kids? How are they functioning? I think that is exactly what this is talking about in general terms, but the specifics get so difficult. Now, verse 7. As God's trustee, boy, that is a really strong passage. You mean we really are God's trustee, that we are entrusted with the good news? Oh, boy. That's exactly what I think we are. not just ministers, but all Christians. As God's trustee, the pastor must be above reproach. Notice again, it's almost another introduction. And so what are some other qualifications here? Well, we listed some, and now we're going to get some more. Number one, he must not be stubborn. You ever met a stubborn pastor? You say, no. Well, you haven't been around long. Stubbornness is something that doesn't work well with people, especially volunteer people. So one of the things is he can't be overbearing or self-willed. He needs to seek the Lord's will, be open to a consensus, be willing to work in whatever structures the church chooses to do authority structures in. The second one, he can't be quick-tempered. He can't be hot-headed. I think if we parallel this with Timothy, this would be the words gentle and peaceful in Timothy, 1 Timothy 3, that are here, not quick-tempered. Now, this next one, I wish I was a bold person. Sometimes I think I'm not. I am a teacher. I'm committed to the Bible. I believe the Bible is the only source for faith and practice. I go verse by verse so that when I hit something like this, I have to address it. But I'm worried about you not being able to take what I say. I mean, I've been praying about it all day long. I'm just worried you will not be able to receive what I'm about to say. And I'm scared of two different groups. One group is going to say, yes, I knew that was right. And the other is going to say, no, kill him. And I'm scared of both. I'm scared of both. And the problem is this addicted to strong drink. Literally, it means alongside wine. Now, in context, my friends, in context, this can't mean total absence. This does not say addicted to no wine. It says not addicted to much wine. All these people in culture drank wine. You say, no, they drank Welch's. Oh, spare me. The rabbis say once the grape is popped, in 6 hours you have to tithe it because it starts to foam. There's little bugs in there, and that's what causes it to foam, and that's where fermentation occurs. We have not been able to stop fermentation until about 100 or so years ago when we started using extremely hygienic conditions and chemical additives. Before that, wine made. I mean, there it was. Bingo. It's grape. There's the wine. You say, now wait a minute here. I mean, we have a rule that... here's the problem, isn't it? See, we've made the rule harder than the Bible. American culture, it has a problem with alcohol. There's no question about that. And our culture has been influenced by the prohibition movement that's only 60 or 70 years in the past, where we tried as a society, this is destroying homes, this is doing bad things, let's just get rid of it as a society, and it didn't work. And so there's a mentality in Baptists that says, this is not good, so I'm going to draw a fence and say, don't do it, and therefore you won't do it. Oh, yuck. I mean, it's almost like saying sick 'em to a dog to somebody to say, don't do it. I've been overseas enough. I was in Argentina. I was in Europe. And, you know, the pastor of one of these evangelical churches, a Baptist church in Argentina, asked me through the interpreter, Brother Bob, do you want white wine or red wine with your dinner? Slap your mama. Man, who do you think I am? You know that church in Quilmes, Buenos Aires, gave me 6 beer glasses to remember them by. Great. What am I going to do with 6 beer glasses? Now, wouldn't I have been the height of an arrogant person to tell that pastor in Argentina, oh, wow, how terrible of a person you are? I would not. I was showing my culturalness. This same thing. Well, Jesus never drank wine. That's not true. Even if you have problems with the wedding feast of Canaan, and I don't think you can even do it there, but I want you to know it says that Jesus took vinegar on the cross, and vinegar is nothing but old wine that's gone too far. Now, here's my fear. The minute I say that wine is a gift from God that gladdens the hearts of men, that's Psalms 104, 14, 15, People say, oh, good, that means I can do it. I've been looking for somebody to tell me. I don't mean that at all. The Bible rails against drunkenness, rails against it. But it does not teach total abstinence. That's why the qualifications for deacon, both here and in 1 Timothy 3, say not addicted to much wine. Now, my culture has a problem. I preach in this culture. So what I do is I go to Romans 14, which says that I'm not going to let any freedom of mine cause Christ to be put down. So I have chosen as an individual, because of my love for Christ, I have chosen to limit my freedom in this culture so that nobody will turn off my preaching for freedom that I have. And I think all of us have to do it on a one-on-one, self-limiting basis. And I think the church covenant of the Baptist church is hypocrisy when it says that no one can be a member who uses this or this. Why don't we just stick something else in there, like no one who cusses at work or uses GD or smokes or eats too many beans or something is can't be a member? What gives you the right to do something the Bible doesn't even say and take somebody out of the church because you don't happen to like it as an evangelical? If you ever went beyond your own parochial avenue, you would realize that many Christians in the world don't agree with you who love God as much as you do. It's this arrogance that bothers me. Well, I don't drink and I'm better than you, huh? Really? It's this put down of everybody else in the name of our over-legalism that bothers me so badly. Not that we choose to be a denomination of abstainers. You have no right to project your views on other Christians when it's not biblical. You have every right to decide what you're going to do as an individual, as a family, and walk in that light in love. Well, I hope this hasn't hurt you too bad, but it sure is painful. Boy, now you've given all of our young people a license. If I've given you a license, you haven't heard what I've said. I'm saying that what I have chosen to do, and you have to choose to do, is to limit your freedoms in the culture you live for the cause of Christ. And if that, whatever that means. Now, I'm willing to quit anything for a sincere seeker after God. I'm not willing to quit everything for some burnt-over legalist in every church I go to. And you've got to make the decision of what you're going to let others... I think there are Baptists somewhere who think that saliva taken in small amounts over long periods is sin. I just know there are. I've grown up in... Baptists are... Well, we don't play cards here. We don't play dominoes here. We don't go to shows here. And that makes us more godly? No, what that makes us is harder to reach people for Christ. Makes us self-righteous. That doesn't make us more biblical. See, we've got to get back to the Bible is the only source for faith and practice. Well, that's true until it kicks one of my cows, right? I challenge you to look through this yourself. I challenge you to struggle with it. And then draw a line clearly in your own life for the cause of Christ. Well, God, I've done the best I know how to do this. Please, please protect me in this. The next one have is not pugnacious, which means he just doesn't want to poke you in the nose. He's not a fighter, not a striker. It is tough to have a pastor that gives bloody noses. He's not addicted to dishonest gain. Same word addicted, and it means he's not out to get money. We're reflecting some of the false teachers here. You mean the false teachers were drunkards, the false teachers were fighters, the false teachers were out for money, the false teachers abused authority, the false teachers had sexual kind of looseness. It's exactly what the false teachers did. These qualifications are viewed against the backdrop of that culture and that day and those false teachers. We may, as a church, want to add or change some of this. That's fine. But we've got to remember when we do that, we're doing it in Christian wisdom, not in biblical authority. Notice hospitable here. Most of the inns in the early world were houses of prostitution. There was no Holiday Inn. Therefore, church leaders had to open their homes to itinerant Christian workers. And it says lovers of strangers is the Greek here. Opening your home. I think we all should open our home to those in need.
It's very hard for us, but we need to. Lovers of the good. Now, what does that mean? Was it related to the thing about hospitality? I don't know. It's just a little more wide. Lovers of the good. It's a play on lovers of strangers, lovers of the good. The word sensible here means a balanced person. It's used so often in Greek lists of virtues. It's someone who doesn't go to either extreme. It's the golden mean. It's a balanced life. That's the word sensible, what it means. Upright and pure. These words always go together. Holy and just. They're used over and over in the Bible. And what it seems to mean is an appropriate attitude and action toward God that issues in an appropriate attitude and action toward men. Holy and just. Self-control. This is the last one of this list. A self-controlled person is someone that, because of their relationship to Christ, has been able to control the passions, drives, and desires of the fallen nature. Doesn't say he's not tempted. Doesn't say he may not make a mistake here and there. But overall, it's a person who has brought that which is not pleasing to God under some kind of control with the Spirit's help personally. A self-control. This is one of the gifts of what? The fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5:23. And then it continues, where a man who clings, this is a present middle participle, emphasis on the man who continues to glue or cling to what? The trustworthy message. And here it's as he was taught. The things that Paul the Apostle passed on, the things that Titus as his surrogate passed on, there was no written Bible here. These were to hold on to this message of truth that they heard from these men in authority from Christ. And so they want elders who are going to hang on to what they heard. Let me put it this way. I get so nervous sometimes. I think our educational system almost breeds this when we say, to get a doctorate, you have to expand the area of knowledge. Think of some new thing to write on. We don't need something new to write on. What we want to be is a faithful link in the chain of historic Christianity. We don't want to be a gold chain or a platinum chain or a decorated chain or a really big chain. Just a chain link. We just want to keep passing on the historical truths about Christ that were passed on to us. And that's the guides here. And a man who is a leader should hang on to this apostolic truth so that he may be competent to encourage others. Now, here's what the leader should do. Be able to encourage others and teach others. So, he's somebody who has some gifts of teaching. Pastor-teacher is one gift in Ephesians 4. Not only should he be able to help the flock to develop, but he should be able to refute the false teachers. So the sword is two-edged. Number one, to be sure that the followers of Jesus are not led off into error by maybe sincere false teachers or super intellectual false teachers. The elder must be a barrier, a protector, and he must be an encourager and a teacher for those inside. And these are the qualifications that are mentioned here in Titus. I think these are qualifications that would be good for all of us. This is nothing more, really, than a description of a godly life. And again, I think that we need to be careful of trying to make the standard of judgment more difficult for leadership type. We all live in a glass house. If anybody starts throwing rocks, there'll be no houses left. And so one thing I have tried to do with you, and I will continue to try to do it with you, is to try to get off this pedestal you put me on. And whatever it takes, I'll get off of it. And then what I'm going to try to do is put you on the pedestal. Because all of us are responsible to Christ for how we live every day. All of us are full-time, gifted ministers. And when it finally dawns on us, now yes, some of us are called out for leadership roles. No question about that. Is there a double standard, a heavier qualification? I think not. Are there gifts that may do that? Yes. So, I hope you'll pray through this list again. I hope you will compare this list with 1 Timothy 3. It is similar but different. I know I've brought some things up tonight that you're uncomfortable with. I think the only thing to do with that is before you say that's just not true, it's only fair to me and this text that you spend a little time struggling with this text itself. If I have misrepresented this text, then I am not to be trusted. But if I have faithfully represented this text, then it becomes important that you think through it and see how you believe it fits with other texts to guide your life. Is that fair? What I've decided to do on these Sunday night services where we teach the Bible, I feel like I lose something of the continuity from the text to this the invitation time when I ask for questions and comments. So what I've decided to do from now on is say to you, I would be happy to talk to anyone about anything that I've talked about, be happy to discuss it, hear your opinions, and I'm going to meet right over there in that section after service as long as you want to stay. And those of you who may not want to do that, you can't hear because you're so far back, you can just pray on the way home they don't kill the preacher, would you? I enjoy this give and take. It is not a threat to me, really. And I really do enjoy it. And I can articulate what I believe and why. And I'm glad to give that to you, but I don't want to give it to you as a dogmatic, this is the only way. I want to give it to you as one sincere seeker of truth that loves and believes the Bible's understanding of this in our cultural context. And then let you, in your light, in your gifts, in your understanding, find where the lines are for you, and then under Christ's help, not step over them. Lord, I thank you for tonight. I have worried about this all week. I just knew this was going to be somewhat distressful. But God, if it's distressful, that helps us think through. If it's distressful so we can better be equipped to be your ministers and servants, then I guess, Lord, I'm willing to do that. I struggle with this, Lord. I don't know anybody who's perfect. And the more I know preachers, I know they're not perfect. And many of us don't fit all these qualifications all of our life. And Lord, I know that you forgive us and you love us. And yet you want us to live in such a way as to attract people. It's so difficult, Lord, and yet thank you for walking with us and loving us. Thank you for the gifts of ministry, and we pray, God, that you would give us the fruit of the Spirit to balance our gifts of the Spirit. We need to look like you day by day and not just function in certain ways at certain times. God, I know there are questions that Christians have about this stuff. And I know there are sincere and godly people that disagree. And I pray you would help us walk in the light that we have without projecting our light on everybody else. And I pray you would help us to speak the truth in love and not to be ugly with one another. I thank you for Titus, Lord. It forces me to deal with some things I normally wouldn't deal with. But I think I need to. It makes me uncomfortable, but I think that's your Spirit. I think your Spirit makes those of us who are comfortable uncomfortable and makes the uncomfortable comfortable in Jesus. So maybe we need this. I pray that we do. I pray that you protect us and me from the evil one who takes what God gives and takes it beyond God-given bounds. I'm afraid of him because he so easily tricks me. And I pray for all of us that you would keep our hearts and minds in Jesus Christ, that we would gird up the loins of our minds in truth and then stand in love shoulder to shoulder with brothers and sisters who know you.